Welcome to the 78th episode of the Jamie Delaney Plant-Based Wellness Podcast. My name is Jamie Delaney, and I'm your host. I'm a plant-based cardiologist and endurance athlete living in Southwest Florida. Welcome. Today's episode is just me and Samantha. We're going to talk a little bit about junk food to health nut, and is that a realistic goal? If you've listened to this podcast before, you know I teach a plant-based nutrition course in my office, and I talk about plant-based nutrition with virtually anybody that steps foot in an exam room with me. I think it has something to offer for everybody, no matter what their age is. Certainly, there's some people that I get shut down with very quickly, and sometimes I get way too enthusiastic when somebody comes into the office, especially if they're having problems such as chest pain or high blood pressure or diabetes, and especially if they're on the younger side, lesser side of 70 and certainly the lesser side of 50. I get pretty excited that I want them to change their ways as quickly as they can to make all this stuff go away. And the reality of it is the younger that you are and you change your ways, the quicker that you can make things go away, such as high blood pressure, high cholesterol, in diabetes, or even glucose intolerance. And, you know, starting there a little bit, you know, that glucose intolerance is really defined as anything above 100. And really, there was a study published in the New England Journal of Medicine several years ago that showed that men with a glucose of 90 were already having insulin resistance, meaning that they had higher insulin levels than they should, and they were really pre-diabetic. So don't be satisfied with a fasting glucose of 100 or 105, because oftentimes you already have high triglycerides, and oftentimes the high insulin levels also put you at risk for many of the side effects of diabetes, such as stroke, vascular disease, and kidney disease. So it's not safe to be glucose intolerant or borderline diabetic. And if you do get that diagnosis of borderline diabetes, it's not something to say, whoosh, I'm glad I just have borderline, because, again, you're almost certain to become diabetic if you don't do something to radically change your course. And that radical change is, you know, easiest through a whole food plant-based diet. Which brings me back to radical versus, you know, the junk food. So if you were living, or if someone is living the junk food standard American diet, eating out fast foods a couple times a week, having pizza, having Kentucky Fried Chicken, I hope they don't come after me for such things because it's considered a dinner, you're at risk for developing a lot of these problems. And it's not that easy to get that craving of salt and fat and all of a sudden start eating healthy. And it often is people are very fearful when I start talking about changing their nutrition to start eating a whole food plant-based diet. And it's so radical that sometimes they're scared away. There are a lot of obstacles in the way, namely when you drive up and down the road. Here in Southwest Florida, where I live, we have just about every chain restaurant available, and there are no fully plant-based vegetarian restaurants available. So if someone does go out, then they're going to have to pick and choose. We do have two health food stores in town. And certainly the regular grocery store has lots of options. We have a really good produce stand, and we have a farmer's market on the weekend. So there are options, but there are certainly more obstacles than options if you're just driving down the road. The other obstacle tends to be the vegan police. You know, I was talking with someone this week, and they decided to adopt a whole food plant-based diet. Mainly because of a radical diagnosis in the family of colon cancer. And one of the first things that happened was resistance from a grandchild, that she didn't want to eat that way. And so that put stress on them that they weren't going to be able to provide her with food that she craved. And the second thing that happened was actually their daughter brought up that when they had fish on Saturday that they weren't the real vegan, they were a different kind of vegan. So that brings up a bunch of guilt. And so the vegan word even of itself brings up, do people have to declare that they're something? You know, when you're eating the standard American diet, nobody declares themselves as anything except what you might call normal eaters, or I eat healthy is something that people often refer to when they don't eat fast foods or they don't eat out as much as other people. So they consider themselves healthy eaters. But that healthy eater diagnosis or definition is extremely broad. But when you say vegan, all of a sudden you get boxed into a corner and you're not allowed to make a mistake, or you're not allowed to be in transition. So, you know, I don't think people need to declare themselves vegan, you know, and truly to define that, you know, a true vegan by the sense of the vegan society is abstaining from all eating any animal product, including honey, as well as wearing leather products. The vegan and vegetarian society will go one way, and they'll actually limit it, and I think this is a good way to limit or to define it as I'm a healthy eating vegan, or I'm an animal activist vegan, or I am environmental vegan. You know, that may be a better way to declare it if you need to declare it, but I don't even think you need to declare it. I think that I'm trying to eat plant strong and for my health is a way, when we're talking on this show especially, for wellness. But, you know, when somebody is judged, you know, when they're especially in transition for what they're eating, or somebody's watching what they order, I think it puts, you know, a lot of undue pressure on them. They're already trying to figure out how to do it themselves without being judged or scrutinized. You know, today is the National Donut Day. I'm not sure where that came from. I don't think it's a Hallmark holiday, but because I've not got any cards on Happy Donut Day. But I did hear this morning at my swim practice, it's Donut Day. Do vegans eat those? Can you have those? And, you know, my first thought was, well, certainly, but why would I want those? My grandmother made great donuts when I was little. They were a heavy flour, sugary dessert that was deep fried in oil. And I can remember to this day how heavy they were. And I can also remember, you know, having donuts when Dunkin' Donuts first came out, and my dad would pick them up on a Sunday morning occasionally. And even as a kid, I would get indigestion from those things, that, you know, the deep fried sensation. So, you know, vegan or not, you know, donuts are not a health food by any stretch of the imagination. And I don't feel deprived because I'm not eating donuts, because of all the discomfort that they've caused me over the years. And certainly I can come up with some other more healthy treat to have for breakfast these days than a donut. But nevertheless, you know, I got to ask, can I have that? And it's not that I can't have something, it's that I choose not to have something. And I think that's where people need to make the transition, is that it's okay if you want to have a donut, but I'm going to choose not to have a donut because I don't want it, as opposed to I've declared myself a vegan and I'm not allowed to have it. I think that's when people start to feel that they're being penalized for declaring themselves a vegan. The other issue that I ran into in the office this week is I had, you know, I've talked about my kind of kickstart program for people, where I have them eat oatmeal and blueberries and rice with just steamed cabbage, carrots, and zucchini. And I had... I guess it's probably my second or third patient to fail that for a 2-week trial. And it seems, you know, difficult that it seems a little bit that somebody couldn't stick to it for 2 weeks, especially when they knew they were going to have to come back in and face me. And it almost backfired to the point where, it did backfire to the point, not only did the person not lose weight, but they actually gained a pound. So maybe that was my fault, because I said, you know, it was too radical to go from, you know, unhealthy eating to this very, very strict diet for 2 weeks. So obviously I didn't read that person well enough, and I needed to either make that follow-up in 2 or 3 days, which again, it makes it very difficult because of, you know, people being able to be seen in a short period of time. But that transition, obviously they needed more help than to just, you know, be given something, we're going to be strict for 2 weeks without any kind of supervision or support. And one of the problems with this particular person was that there were functions at work where she had to go to. And, of course, they had the standard American diet fare, and they had things that she liked. And she didn't want to have to answer questions or declare that she couldn't eat something or that she was on some sort of radical diet, because she didn't want to have to answer questions about it, I suppose. And that's what I think. Although she was too kind to really, you know, throw me under the bus for her failure. But, you know, it's very difficult when you go out and all of a sudden you're going to do something very different from all those people around you. It's kind of like, you know, having an alcoholic have to go to the bar for their first week of sobriety. It's a hugely difficult challenge. To be around that environment. So, you know, the best way of success is to not be around, you know, that kind of environment. But again, that's very difficult as well, because people want to be social. And if it's going to limit their social connections, then they're not going to want to do it. So we have to find ways around it. And my suggestion to her was to bring a dish that you could eat and share with them. So, you know, a vegetable dish that, you know, could have been, it could have been a cabbage dish. It could have been my, you know, vegan, my vegetable, my sushi salad, or something along those lines. Would have been something that she could have eaten, but still had the things that she was, you know, allowed to on her on her restriction. The other thing would have been to eat beforehand so that she wasn't quite as tempted, but still go and socially interact. But that, you know, the other problem she also had was then again, when she got home late, she, you know, she fell off the wagon, so to speak, because she didn't, you know, was frustrated and didn't want to continue to eat that in a restricted diet. So I guess there's a couple ways to look at, you know, whether you're being gypped because you don't get to eat the sweet foods or the salty foods or the fatty foods, or it's a blessing that you've taken that off your plate. And if you declare that you're not going to do those, and if you declare it, it's for my health and to people, then it sometimes puts a little bit of pressure on you. That's a good thing, that, you know, those people will police you, and it's like, okay, well, you have to eat this because, you know, of your illness. Because again, nobody would make you eat, nobody's going to make an insulin dependent diabetic eat a piece of cake or something sweet. They're not going to do that for fear of what would happen to their, you know, their blood sugars. The same thing happens if people are, you know, have multiple problems. Making them eat this high fat, high salt food is not in their best interest. I think sometimes, you know, if you look at the vegetarian society polls, probably I think the most recent polls, it's around 3% of the population are vegetarians, 3 to 6%, depending on what poll you take. And, you know, even a fraction of, you know, less than that is I think 30% of that are vegans for various reasons. So in that percentage, you have the junk food vegans, and then you have the vegans that are more, you know, health-based vegans. But just that small population, there's this higher standard, or I guess supposed more, you know, you're supposed to have more willpower, you're supposed to have more nutritional knowledge, you're supposed to, you know, be less likely to fall off your chosen way of eating, as opposed to other people that, you know, may be low carb dieting. Except when they go out and then they have all kinds of crazy things, because most people that are on a low carb diet don't truly follow it very long. They start adding their carbs back in or their processed foods that have sugar in them or what have you. But it's not as well defined when people say, I'm not eating carbs. You know, as long as they're not eating bread or pasta, then they can have something with sugar in it. Nobody's going to really notice. So I just think that there's such a high standard for people that declare themselves vegan or plant strong or plant-based that, you know, sometimes that pressure leads people to fail. And maybe it should be, you know, more along that I'm going to be plant strong. I'm going to declare myself plant strong, but I'm also going to cut myself a break if I have a little bit of a lapse now and then, especially during transition. You know, there's such a wide variety of, you know, you can eat prepared vegan foods and, you know, we've talked before, Oreos and Twizzlers are vegan. I'm not suggesting people eat that way, but if someone were to have a veggie burger that's not low oil versus, you know, a hamburger on occasion, I still think that they're, you know, that's a better transition. If they've got to put the tofu crumbles into their chili, I think that's an okay transition. If they have to have small amounts of meat once a week or once a month, with a plan that they're going to decrease it, or you know, there's some plan that you're going to back that out. One way would be to not have any meat until dinner. One way would be to start by decreasing portion size. Oftentimes people say, well, they have all this stuff in their freezer and they'd like to get rid of it. You know, one option is to give it away, give it to the homeless, but the other option is to slowly get it out of your freezer. So you're consciously weaning yourself off with decreasing portion size. So it may be that, you know, in the old days, everybody would have had a steak. Now you're going to have one steak between everybody. And then it would go down to, well, you're going to have that steak now once a week between everybody. And then it's going to be, you're not going to have any more steak, but you're going to back down the chicken and then you're going to back down. So you can do it really methodically. I think it's a really good thing to try to cut the dairy out very quickly as far as cheese, because it's in everything. I think it's an easy way to say, okay, you're not going to have eggs that you can see, and then back it down to, oh, well, you know, not scrutinize. If you had something that had eggs in it, well, I wouldn't beat yourself up too much for that. And then as you transition, then start to look at things more closely and back away from things that had eggs cooked in it. You know, in the same way with fish, in the same way with turkey and pork, you know, I think you can back down on those and then, you know, just really limit the portion size and then they're gone, and have some sort of set goal like people do when they quit smoking, you know, on the 30th of what, I'm going to stop. And so you have a game plan as opposed to, well, I'm just going to try to eat less of it. Because when you say you're just going to try to eat less of it, there's no rules involved. And if there's no rules involved, you have no concept of what you're doing. Time and again, people come in and they don't know why they're not losing weight, because they, you know, they claim that they're not eating anything. And, you know, sometimes I try to kindly point out that if they weren't eating anything, then their weight would be falling off rapidly, because that's what happens to people when they're confined and not having any food whatsoever. So, you know, no calories at all causes weight loss. It just does. People will not gain weight not eating. And so they're eating something, they're just not really aware of it. So if you don't define the rules of what you're going to eat, then you're not aware truly of what you're eating, and it kind of doesn't count, so to speak. Because we have, I guess, as humans, ability to overlook a lot of things that we're not really paying attention to. I want to hit just a little bit on artificial sweeteners. People often ask, you know, what about artificial sweeteners? Can I use those? What do I use instead of sugar? And, you know, I try to get people to back off. If you can, again, stop using added sugar to things, then that's a perfect way to start. You know, I've heard people put sugar on corn. You know, it's like it's sweet corn. You don't need sugar on it. That's just a habit. My great grandmother used to put sugar on tomatoes. You know, I mean, it's something that, of course, she was a tiny little thing, but it's still, it's something that doesn't need to happen. So, you know, if you stop adding the white sugar to things, then you're back down. And so then the next thing will come is like, well, you know, can I use, and even Dr. Esselstyn and Dr. Furman, you know, and people, a little bit of maple syrup and or a little bit of agave to sweeten things, or dates or raisins. You know, I didn't think, you know, in a different life you could eat oatmeal without a big hunk of brown sugar on top. And now I'm perfectly happy having my oatmeal sweetened with raisins or banana. But it's something that you have to transition into, because it's not as sweet as a big hunk of brown sugar, but it's very sweet compared to, you know, nothing. And it's a way to transition and back off. Sometimes you need to just say, okay, I'm going to do this and it's not sweet, and learn to like the taste of it, and start to appreciate even this, the sweetness in simple fruits. You know, banana or mango on my oatmeal will do the same thing, or strawberries and walnuts will do the same thing. You know, have an apple with the oatmeal, it does the same thing. So you're backing off on sweeteners in general. And if you're having a sweet treat, you know, using the raisins, or especially if you use maple syrup, it's very sweet. You don't need a whole lot of it. And it's expensive, so you're not going to use a whole lot of it. Where, you know, the price of sugar, because it's subsidized, is so cheap that people will just pour cups and cups in things without ever, you know, noticing it. And then when we move on to artificial sweeteners, things like Splenda or sucralose, you know, there was early on an association with triggering migraine headaches. And, you know, if you are a migraine sufferer, those are terrible. And, you know, you'll do just about anything not to have one happen. So really pay attention to whether artificial sweeteners have been put in things that you may eat that you didn't know about, especially the Splenda. The other thing that, you know, people have heard about, that drinking more diet soda leads to increased weight gain. And of course, there's always the added joke, people have a diet soda and a candy bar, so what does that do? You know, again, in a different life, I thought, well, if you had the diet soda, at least you didn't have the 140 calories of the diet soda and the candy bar. But the reality of it is that when people consume sucralose, they actually have a blood sugar spike, which results in an insulin spike, and the onset of basically glucose intolerance. The manufacturers have said over time that, you know, it's barely absorbed, and what's been found is that it's not absorbed in the small intestine, but the sucralose or Splenda gets to the large intestine and alters the gut microbe, or your gut flora, and leads to increased glucose and insulin spike, so that people can, you know, have an alteration in their gut flora, and if you stop for 2 to 8 weeks, that'll return, and the glucose intolerance will actually get better. On the other hand, having a lot of this artificial sweetener can increase your blood sugar for up to a week after ingesting it. So, you know, these diet drinks and people that drink a lot of diet sodas can have as many problems as far as glucose intolerance as people that, you know, are still consuming sugar. So it's not a safe way around it at all. And, you know, besides the other stuff that, especially in the diet sodas, and then, you know, it's just in everything, sugar-free Jell-Os, anything that's sugar-free that, you know, tends to have these artificial sweeteners, and people are fooled into thinking that everything's okay, and they're still having these big insulin spikes and abnormal glucoses and abnormal hemoglobin A1C. So pay attention to that. We're learning more and more about the gut microbes and, you know, their ability to feed back and cause us to be full. And if our gut bacteria are healthy, we're less likely to have a leaky gut. We're less likely to have a lot of inflammation. So, you know, what we eat is very, very important. And then on the other hand, not only do we benefit by taking these artificial sweeteners out, but by when you add the increased fiber of a whole food plant-based diet. You're actually feeding those good gut microbes so that they multiply and do well. And, you know, so you have this positive feedback loop as opposed to a negative feedback loop. And again, just taking, you know, especially a lot of these probiotics over the counter, which are, you know, not really regulated. And then you go ahead and so you take a probiotic and then you have a Snickers and a Diet Coke, it obviously is going to defeat the purpose, because these gut, even if they were good probiotics and they had the good bacteria, these good bacteria are not going to live if they're not fed fiber and nutrients as opposed to Splenda and high fat stuff. So it goes all the way back to there's no pill solution for a poor diet. There's nothing you can eat or drink to make up for eating poor, and actually anything you, if there was a little benefit, it's actually going to get worse. So again, you know, same way with everything else, I would back out the sugar, the white sugar first, and then I would back it out on added sugar to different things, and then I would really get rid of soft drinks that have artificial sweeteners in them. That's an easy way to start. Go to water, go to iced tea, green tea, black tea with lemon, water, fruit-infused water is a good alternative. There's some beneficial effects to the rind of lemon, the rind of oranges, you know, the zest. So adding a little bit of that to the water is a good thing. So again, look to see whether you can add some nutrient densities, and certainly drink plenty of water. The general population probably doesn't drink near enough water. You want to drink till your urine is clear. That being said, when people start to exercise or start to run, there have been a lot of bad things happen when people drink too much when they're exercising. So I do want to caution against that, to drink when you're thirsty, when you're actually in the process of exercising. So when people are training for marathons, there have been people that have died of what they call hyponatremia. And that is not low sodium, but too much water compared to the sodium. So when people have that diagnosis of hyponatremia or low salt, it doesn't really mean there's lack of salt in the body. It means that there's too much water in the body. And, you know, with the development of sports drinks and, again, this hydration thing, people are over-drinking during training for marathons and during some of these racing events. And the reality of it is nobody has died of dehydration during a sporting event, but they have died of this hyponatremia, and it's very, it can cause people to get very ill and die suddenly if they don't watch out. So in general, from day to day, walking, working, you want to make sure that you're well hydrated and you're getting plenty of water to drink. But during training during sporting activities, it's okay to drink to thirst. You don't want to over-drink in that regard. And anybody that's kind of did that, they'll have this bloated type feeling because you tend to, you know, the water tends to stay in your gut anyway, and then all of a sudden you absorb it and you have all this water in your system when you stop. So drink to thirst when you're exercising. And I guess turning a little bit to exercise, and diet, there is a movement out there for a low carbohydrate ketotic type exercise. There's a thought that you can teach your body to burn fat instead of carbohydrates, and you know, even a lot of the treadmills and the gyms will talk about the fat burning zone and the sugar burning zone. And the reality of it is, your body wants to burn carbohydrates, and you have plenty of carbohydrates available, so you're going to burn mostly carbohydrates. And if you don't take any fuel in after a couple hours, your body will start to burn some fat, but your performance also decreases. And there's just eating that way doesn't train your body to improve its fat-burning capacity. It's more of a training effect by training at heart rates that allows your body to have time to burn fat you'll burn, you know, maybe a higher percentage of fat than carbohydrates, but you're always going to be burning carbohydrates and fat. The ratio changes a little bit, but it's based more on your level of fitness more so than, you know, just having starved yourself while exercising. And anybody that's done, you know, if you do the fast and that ketotic, you slow down. Your brain slows down. Everything slows down because your body's just not going to burn fat as quickly. And you're not going to make energy as quickly when you're burning fat as if you have carbohydrates to burn. So, you know, and I it just kind of drives me crazy when I hear people talking about this low carb and this high fat diet when they're exercising, because, again, they're going to have... you know, it worries me about the vasoconstriction and the blood vessel constriction associated with the high fat as well. So I just don't think exercise performance in general is going to be as good as, you know, letting your body fuel naturally with carbohydrates. To my knowledge, there's not an Olympic athlete that goes ketotics, and certainly, you know, the Kenyan runners, they don't run ketotic. They're very efficient, so they don't require as much glucose intake as, you know, the 5-hour marathoner. But they eat carbohydrates. They're not eating sticks of butter before they go out. And then focusing a little bit more about, you know, the average person just wanting to start to get their health back, you know, people that may come and see me, and, you know, the first thing that happens is, you know, people will tell me that they can't lose weight because they're not exercising. And the reality of it is, if you're sedentary for the most part, and you just start, you're not going to burn a tremendous amount of calories by walking three times a week. So that's really not the reason for weight loss failure. It's usually your caloric intake, which is always falls back to pastas and flour products, breads and oils, typically. And, you know, if you're still getting animal products in your diet, especially dairy and these high dense fatty foods. That being said, just like changing your diet, changing your activity level requires some thought and training. And I get things done best in the morning. In Florida, it's very hot, so if I'm going to get my training in, I do it in the morning. And then if I can do a little something in the evening, I do it. And depending on what I'm training for, sometimes that requires. But those evening sessions are a lot harder for me than the morning sessions. I think to get into the habit, you need to have a certain time of day that you do things, and that morning is typically more uninterrupted. So if you just set out short time blocks for your exercise every morning at the same time, I think it's a better way to get started. You know, I always make the joke that if I can get to the point where I have my teeth brushed, then I'm up and I'm ready to go and I'm accepting that I'm going to go out and do something. But sometimes the thought of that 4 o'clock awakening to go swimming is very difficult. But once I'm up and about, then it's, you know, that's a different story. And I'm really happy when it's over and I've had that exercise and the way I feel afterwards. So if you can just make a point, like you brush your teeth, to get up and do your exercise and make that a part of your daily habit, 2 or 3 months into it, then you'll start to feel bad if you don't do it. So you want to, you know, kind of do it every day. This 3-day-a-week thing is something that somebody pulled because they figured if somebody 3 days a week is better than nothing, but you need to do something 7 days a week. Certainly if you're injured or you need, you know, you're exhausted, you need to rest day every once in a while, but you can always find a way to do a little something, 10 minutes of something, 15 minutes of something, especially when you're first starting out in your weight loss journey, perhaps. I think the other thing that's really helpful is to document what you do. Just have a calendar. I write down all what I've done in a calendar that I keep from day to day, year to year. There are a lot of apps that you can get for your phone, you know, with Garmin's and different devices there, you know, you can log things there. They'll track them for you. But I think there's something to be said to be able to have a calendar in the bathroom or at the dinner table or wherever you're in the kitchen, where you can log your workout and you can see what you've done. And you can also see that big black empty box if you've not done something. So I think that's good. That's a good motivator. I do think that the activity bracelets, the Fitbits, the Vivio Fits, we sell Vivio Fit here in the office. I do like the Garmin products. I think those are, you know, because you can see right on them how many steps you've done in a day. You have a certain goal, so it motivates you. And if you get out of the car at the grocery store, you might be a little bit more prone to walk a little further if you have one of those on that you can tell your steps. I like the ones that you can see right then and there, not that you have to download. I think that that feedback is really, really good for you. And, you know, and I exercise every day, but I still like to see those steps. It's still a motivator for me. I think if you have a buddy that you meet at the gym, that's a helpful thing to do. If you can't get going, personally, I like my runs. I like my quiet runs in the morning for the most part. It's the dogs and myself. It's meditative for me. But if you need help to get out, I think that's you know, a good thing to do as well. Certainly signing up for an event, whether it's a 5K or a fun walk or something, gives you a motivator to train. You know, it gives you something that, you know, you've got to work back from and set a goal for. I think setting goals are very good. So those are kind of, you know, good things that I suggest to my patients that want to start walking. I also think that when you're first starting out, you shouldn't make it too painful. You know, if you go to the gym and every muscle and bone aches terribly and you can't do anything for 3 days, that really defeats the purpose. So you need to start out really slow, you know, and exercise as much as it's enjoyable. So I'll tell people to walk for, you know, 15 minutes once a day, out 7 minutes, back, you know, 7.5 minutes. That way they can get it done. They feel good afterwards and they're not too sore to do it again. Because I think, again, that the more days in a row that you do get training in, the better off you'll be, as opposed to being terribly sore and not doing something for, again, a week or the risk of injuring yourself. So you need to work up quickly. And, you know, there are so many people doing, go from 5Ks, and certainly I did it to myself. I did it myself. I had never run a race, and I signed up for a marathon. So then I kind of worked back, and I signed up for a 5 mile run, and then a 10 mile run, and then a half marathon, and then I did the marathon. But it takes a lot longer for the little tendons and your feet and everything to get used to being on your feet and running. So, you know, working your way up slow is a lot better. And, you know, I look at the 10% rule. I think that's really good when you're starting out, that don't add anything more than 10% a week to your total volume until your body's adapted. I also think that range of motion is huge, being flexible. We tend to sit all day, expect that 1 hour of exercise is going to cure all our woes. So we go out and we do one activity, whether it's run or bike or something, and then we sit all hunched over a computer or sit at a desk or don't do much, or do the same activity day in and day out, which is, you know, part of being an adult. But we tend to kind of grow like a tree in the wrong direction. So it's real important to keep your mobility, especially as you get older, and your flexibility. So things like yoga and different stretchings, you know, I think it's real important. So incorporating that into your daily routine or weekly routine is real important. You know, if you can't get off the floor, if you're an adult, older adult, then you need to work your way to the point where you can get off the floor. In Okinawa, you know, one of the blue zones, they sit on the floor to eat, you know, the 90, 100-year-olds. So, you know, how many 100-year-olds, you know, do you know in the United States that can get up off the floor? Not too many. But the flexibility of getting out of a chair without your hands or getting off the floor that's needed is huge. So, you know, it's good to test yourself on, you know, can you do certain things? And it, again, it keeps you, you know, just that getting down and getting up is a huge range of motion that is really protective. On the front of what I've been eating the last couple of days, I guess the biggest thing that I've tried is eggplant bacon. And that is made in the dehydrator. Again, it's eggplant thinly sliced with a sauce that's marinated. with soy sauce, a little bit of a chipotle pepper that's been rehydrated in that juice from that or the water from that, a little maple syrup and some cumin and chili powder and a little cayenne. And it's really, really good. I didn't need a dehydrator. It's crispy. It passed inspection with my biggest raw food critics, that being my mother. So when she says something is okay and it's raw, then it is, because she's not a fan of things that are, you know, not the real thing, so to speak. The other thing, so she made a BLT with that tonight and really liked it. I also have done sushi a couple nights, and the sushi that I make is usually with a little avocado, carrot, cucumber, red cabbage, and red pepper, and some rice. That's something that I really like. It's almost a comfort food for me. We have a traditional green bean, sweet potato, and pasta with some fresh tomatoes, usually once a week or once every other week that we did that. I made a corn chowder one evening, and then I had some leftover black beans and leftover roasted potatoes, and I threw that in. So we had that one evening. I really like the zucchini with a pesto made from some cashew and fresh basil and some other spices and garlic. So that's really good. And we almost always, or maybe once a week, do a bean burrito with rice and beans. I like a green sauce made out of tomatillos. I think I had some sun-dried tomatoes left over that I made a salsa with some peppers and onions. So that was good this week. So some things like the eggplant bacon take a little bit of thought when you have to dehydrate things, but beans and rice burritos are pretty quick, and there's always beans left over. I always make a big pot of beans in my Instapot, so I have beans left over. So that's good, and I always make a little bit of extra rice, so if I wanted to do sushi the next day, I can do that. I did a different breakfast this week. I soaked buckwheat groats, and then I added raisins and a date and some cinnamon and then blueberries that morning, and that was really filling. I did that after a swim practice when I'm usually really hungry, so that was really good. I do my smoothie. It always has blueberries, it always has kale or spinach, and it always has a banana in it. And then we've had a really good watermelon because it's watermelon season in Florida, so you put some watermelon in, that's always refreshing. It's also mango season, so we've been having a lot of mangoes in there. I'll take a mango for lunch. I always have fruit for lunch as well. I've been dehydrating some apple slices for snacks on occasion, or to put in my oatmeal. That's really good. So that's kind of you know, what we've been eating over the last week or so. You know, I'd encourage you to find a few meals that you like and then add to them. Try maybe some one new meal a week that's different, or one dish that's different. It can become frustrating if you make a meal that people don't like, or that they're less than happy with. So, you know, if you're experimenting, you know, maybe just once a week do your experimentation so that you're not frustrated over and over again. One other thing that I made was a raw jicama gnocchi with a red pepper sauce, and had the asparagus in that, and that was really, really tasty and different. So, you know, that was my experimentation for the week. I would do that again. I might make the pepper sauce a little more spicy. It was red pepper, both dehydrated and raw, that was made in the Vitamix, but I'd probably make that a little spicier, add something to that. I tend to like spice and a little heat to things. I like to make sure I have beans. You know, beans are one of those things, if you look raw versus, you know, sprouted versus cooked beans, it's pretty much a wash. There's some things that are better sprouted. There's some antioxidants that are better absorbed when they're cooked. So I think a combination of cooked beans and then sprouted mung beans is good during the week. There's also a study that showed that having about a half a cup of beans a day will actually lower your heart rate, The mechanism is unknown, but it's worth doing because a lower heart rate is associated with increased longevity. Of course, the other thing you can do to lower your heart rate is exercise. So it seems counterintuitive, but if you increase your heart rate for a little bit, then your resting heart rate will start to decline, and that's a sign of health. So the heart rate, people will say, what's a normal heart rate, or they're afraid of low heart rates, but the normal heart rate is somewhere between 45 and 85. Anything higher is actually associated with increased mortality, so you want to do whatever you need to do to lower your heart rate, so exercise, but beans certainly is an easy way to do it if you're not doing much exercise. So eat your beans, even if you have to do some sprouted mung beans if you're not a bean person. Put those on your salads. You can sprout some lentils, put those on your salads. They have a whole different flavor than regular beans. Sneak beans into chili, puree some, put them in with other things. When I did my corn chowder, I actually had, I threw in some black beans, but I also threw in cauliflower. So there's a way to hide vegetables if you're not fond of some vegetables into soups, with purees. When I make my butternut squash soup, I'll, put a sweet potato and carrots in there. But you can add cauliflower into there, so you're adding some vegetables and you're retaining the broth, so that's also good. And I guess the funny, it's not really funny, but the one thing that I found interesting this week is someone called up and was inquiring about becoming a new patient in my office, and they wanted to become vegan, but they didn't want to be a mushy vegan. They wanted to be fit. And I heard my secretary describing me as being a fit plant-based vegan. And I kind of chuckled to myself because not many people call up to get an appointment with a cardiologist and ask, whether their cardiologist is fit. I think it's a reasonable question. I think if your cardiologist is pudgy and overweight, that you need to look for a new cardiologist. Certainly, you need to look for a new doctor if they're overweight. Obviously, because they're not going to know much about nutrition if they're not taking care of themselves. But, the majority of people aren't that fit. And as far as physicians, they tend not to be that healthy. And they eat the standard American diet. So, worrying about the, unfit vegan, it is kind of funny. Nobody worries about the unfit person that's following the standard American diet, but they worry about the vegan that looks bad. Again, it goes back to that double standard of, we expect vegans to be healthy and live forever. And, a whole food plant-based diet is certainly, I believe, the best diet for longevity, but it won't make you live forever. So there, time will get us all eventually. But I think you have the best chance of living well before you die being plant-based than, eating the standard American diets chased by Twinkies and Oreos. So anyway, that was, I thought, kind of a funny inquiry. That being said, I there are a lot of people that their perception of what is fit anymore is, I think, a little outdated. Thinking the old Jack LaLanne, if you can pinch an inch, I think that should be more along the standard what we think about. A lot of people get worried that they're losing weight that when they become plant-based, and they're really only achieving normal weight. So ask your doctor what your body mass index is, and certainly if it's in the normal range, I wouldn't be too concerned that you're losing weight. One of the side effects of a whole food plant-based diet is that weight kind of gradually falls off of you and you become more lean. So it doesn't happen overnight necessarily, but it's kind of a steady decrease in your overall body mass. And the parts of you that have the most fat on them are the last parts that, become thin. So oftentimes if people carry their weight in their midsection, their arms or their face may become thin and everybody panics that something awful is happening to them, when in reality it's just the normal leaning up associated with a whole food plant-based diet. So congratulations if that's you. I think we'll probably wrap it up for today. Certainly, if you are transitioning to a plant-based diet or you already are plant-based, help somebody out, but don't be too hard on them and try to be supportive. and continue your journey. If you fall off the wagon, get back on. It's a process. You know, nobody was perfect the first time. There's a lot of things to think about. There's more things stacked against you as far as marketing goes and things to fool you than there isn't. So, try your best every day and gradually, try to become a little bit better over time. Again, set some goals for yourself as far as exercise goes. If you have any questions for me, feel free to email me at jamiedulaney@gmail.com. It's jamiedulaney@gmail.com. Please check my website out at drdulaney.com. And if you're in the area, join us for a nutrition session. There's meetup.com. We Charlotte County Plant-Based Foodies. You can join us there as well. So if you have any questions, give me a call. Otherwise, be plant strong, get out and do some exercise, enjoy the summertime sunshine, and all the natural vitamin D.